Last week on Chip Chat, we introduced you to Genevieve Bell, anthropologist and Intel fellow responsible for research into how people around the world want to adopt technology into their lives. Her team's work has influenced not just products being delivered today, but how Intel is really shaping the world of technology of the future. Today, we continue the conversation with a look at the social media explosion that's circling the globe, its impact on our global culture, and a little about what Genevieve has in common with Tyra Banks.
Welcome to Chip Chat, an interview series that connects you with technology experts around the issues that industry is focused on today. And now your host, Allison Klein.
What do you see as social media's broader impact? Is it going to be one of those technologies that sticks with us, like the television or the cell phone? And what kind of implication does it have to how we view friendship, how we view privacy, how we view language, how we view government?
Wow. Where do you start answering that?
I think it's a big question, and it's one that my friends and I, frankly, talk about quite a bit.
So, I mean, I think there's a couple of things that, you know, one might want to unpack out of that. For as much as many of us who work in the tech industry are consumed by those technologies, there are huge swaths of the population who aren't. It's really easy to think everyone must be using Twitter, and yet I still find myself having to explain to people what it is.
Sure.
And you know, lots of people who still haven't heard of it, or of Facebook or MySpace or any of those things. So there's a piece that says how we imagine ourselves and how we imagine ourselves in relationship with others is hardly stable. And it's had lots of kind of reconfigurations. I mean, think of women moving into the workforce in the last 50 years and how that meant changes in how families got structured.
Mm-hmm.
Think about changing ideas about marriage, about love. You know, they're no longer quite so tightly coupled in the West. There's certainly, if you look at age at first marriage, if you look at the number of people who aren't marrying, if you look at the number of people who cohabitate and have children outside of marriage, all of those things have profoundly shifted in 50 years. And it doesn't surprise me that they're being reconfigured again now. And indeed, many of the anxieties that you get manifested around social media were also manifested around television and
sure.
telephone and some of the early ideas about even giving women an education. There was an idea, well, you give women degrees, they might not get married.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we sort of have these really interesting ways where we bolt new technologies onto old anxieties. All of that said, do I think it's like television or the phone? I don't think so, but only insofar as I don't think of it as a technology, I think of it as a set of experiences.
Okay.
And I think there's a piece that says, while the Twitters and Facebooks and MySpaces of this world may not survive for the next 40 years, they point to and obviously resonate with a very particular set of experiences. And I don't think those are going to go away. We have an ongoing relationship to nostalgia that suggests to us that there were points in our lives that are better than the one we find ourselves in now, and we keep wanting to make connections back to it.
Well, that's the hope, yes.
Yes, and it turns out not to be true. Mm-hmm. You know, I think in many regards, it's, you know, it's simply what it is. It's nostalgia, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I also think, you know, there's some interesting moves starting to happen that I sort of see glimpses of people feeling like this might all have been a bit overexposing. And I have a number of colleagues, and I've certainly heard it in a number of interviews, starting to talk about scaling back some of that sense of living one's life across social networking and social media sites.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, if you look at the churn rate on Twitter, it's a nice example. I mean, I think Second Life saw a similar kind of people logging on to see what it was all about and not staying.
I could never get off the Second Life island. That was a failed technology for me.
Yeah, well, but, you know, Twitter sees a 60% turnover in a month of mm-hmm. people who sign up and aren't still there a month later. So, I mean, I think there's something that says these things have a kind of media profile that doesn't always reflect how people are really using them.
Sure.
But the fact that they got that profile and the fact that people are curious mm-hmm. means they tap into something. But, you know, they also seem to be starting to put a spotlight, at least in the work we've been doing, on some other interesting issues. People feeling like it's a lot of work. I had a bloke say to me recently that maintaining this whole life was just a lot of overhead. Like, you know, it was much easier when it was just people I could see and it was kind of contained, and if I didn't want to deal with them, I didn't have to.
We spend a lot of time thinking about privacy in the industry. Do you think users care about it?
The research we'd done, I mean, really interestingly, started to suggest that in a kind of consumer space, that consumers were far less worried about privacy than we were on their behalves. that, mm-hmm. you know, many consumers imagine that the institutions they deal with, their service providers, their governments, their other kind of credit cards and bank companies, know everything about them. And they assume they already know their income, their age, their gender, you know, many other things about them they assume is already known. And what was fascinating as we started to push on this, people seem to be much less concerned about privacy the way we've traditionally formulated it than they were about their reputations.
Interesting.
And so people would say things like, yeah, well, you know, everyone knows how much money I make, but I don't want everyone to know what I'm quote unquote really watching on television. It's okay for me to say what I'm watching on television, but what I'm really watching, I wouldn't want anyone to know about.
So information flow is okay, but judgment is not.
Exactly.
Interesting.
So privacy, not an issue. Reputation and image, absolutely an issue.
Mm-hmm.
And this notion of the difference between what one was quote unquote really doing and what one was saying one was doing, and the point at which your devices could start to contradict that, was this really interesting point where people went, oh, but if my television could really say what I was watching and there was a shortcut where it just uploaded that to the site, that'd be really bad.
That's funny. Do you see geographical-based cultural differences as the primary determinant of how technology is adopted? Or is it socioeconomic? Or is it gender-based?
I'm not sure I want to give primacy to any of those. I mean, I think they're all important vectors. Gender is a really important determinant of how you relate to technology. And mostly because if you look across the lives of most women around the planet, they're time poor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they are engaged in forms of labor as well as forms of domestic work. They are often balancing paid and unpaid work. They're balancing maintaining households and relationships and kids and parents and in-laws and all manner of other complexities that look like that. And, you know, as a result, women are interestingly early adopters of unexpected things.
Sure.
Women were early adopters in the United States of Wi-Fi technology, I think because it fit into multitasking. Women have been early adopters of consuming certain kinds of streaming media online,
mm-hmm.
the highest percentage of people watching entire television shows, and of time-shifting TV off televisions onto the internet. And you know what that's about.
Yeah,
that's
sure.
about, you know, how do you get a tiny thing back for yourself in a very fragmented day? Women were early adopters of mobile phones. But there's a lot of places where I can see that it's not about some essentialized gender thing. I mean, this is not the pink it and shrink it and women will buy it. This is much more the mm-hmm. the kind of constraints on women's lives are slightly different than on their male partners and peers. I think it's certainly the case that class plays a big role here, socioeconomic circumstance, how much money you have. I think age plays a role, but I suspect it's less about the kind of traditional generations that we think about in marketing terms than it is about life stages. You know, what you do as a new mum may be really different than what you do as a single woman, even if you're the same age and the same cohort. Some of the Gen Xers we've talked to who've had their first kids who say things like, yeah, I used to blog every day. Have you tried using a laptop and breastfeeding? And you think, and then culture. I mean, we know that impacts all kinds of other things. It clearly plays a role here too, both in terms of how you think about what technologies make sense, where they get used, who uses them, who the gatekeepers for them are, and, you know, even how governments talk about and regulate them. In the United States, we don't think of government as setting standards for behavior terribly often. I mean,
right.
Legislating occasionally, but hardly enjoining the population to do something. Mostly
mm-hmm.
enjoining them not to do things. Don't text and drive, don't drink and drive, but not. We don't rarely legislate to say, and you should do this thing instead.
Right.
Whereas, you know, when you look across lots of other governments, there have been really strong statements made by governments about the relationship between technology and citizenship. And whether it is about adopting the internet or engaging in different kinds of activities online or just ideas of what it means to be a good person in that country, that a government could make a statement linking that kind of goodness and righteousness to technology is definitely quite culturally specific and wouldn't make sense here. I think religion makes mm-hmm. a big difference here. Most of the world has some kind of religious tenet, and only about 10% of the planet doesn't believe or isn't in a society that has some deep religious kind of expression. And while I don't mean the specifics of it, most of the tenets of the big world religions spell out quite clearly notions about appropriate relationships,
mm-hmm.
appropriate ideas about time and space, ideas about what constitutes information and what you have to do to get it.
Mm-hmm.
And all of those things ultimately also shape our relationships to technology. I mean, you know, 10 years ago when I joined Intel, 65% of internet users on the planet were in America.
Mm-hmm.
A year ago, it was 17%.
Wow.
Eventually, that's going to start to have an impact on what the underlying ideals are. Because, you know, truthfully, if you've got 300 million Chinese citizens using the internet, they come with very different ideas about information and knowledge practices, really different histories of scholarship.
Mm-hmm.
On, you know, just look at even the kind of language that gets adopted around the internet. On my favorite example of this, Baidu, which is the early, sure. You know, Chinese search engine, right? And also music search. That name has a really particular history. So it's not like Google or Yahoo, the kind of invented words. I mean, Baidu is a word out of a very particular piece of classical Chinese poetry. If you'd been raised in China, you would know this poem almost immediately. And you know it as this poem about a man searching for the perfect woman endlessly and never quite finding her. That is a remarkable metaphor for thinking about a search engine.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, already locates it in history, in an intellectual tradition, in a whole lot of other ways of thinking about knowledge and information and the search for quote-unquote truth. That's really different than calling something Google or Bing.
I like that story.
Yeah, I did too. And I like the fact that it's on their website as a kind of way of articulating why they are who they are. And again, of very much saying, you know, we are part of a deep, rich, long intellectual tradition.
What is the most interesting and surprising use of technology that you've seen in your field work?
Oh, always a good question. So there's been a couple. I had a moment in India when someone explained to me that the most popular website in India was the matrimonial classified section of the Times of India. Well, you know, it's a database problem. And there was something really kind of wonderful about imagining that something as deeply rooted in tradition as matchmaking could find an expression in the newest of technologies. Because frankly, they matched really well together.
Sure.
I think the first time someone showed me how to use a cell phone to find Mecca, and I realized, you know, here's this tool that is in some ways the quintessential expression of modernity or postmodernity being used to support a set of spiritual and religious practices that are hundreds, if not thousands of years old, was a really kind of powerful statement about how those technologies will succeed, because what they let people do is things they've always cared about.
Right.
And, you know, I think I sometimes am also fascinated by the ways we don't want to own our own expertise. I was in a community meeting in Australia 6 months ago, and there was an old fella in this room, and he basically said, oh, I don't know anything about technology. And the woman sitting next to him goes, oh, come on, Ted, you've got a computer at home. He's like, well, I'm 94 years old. Like, and do you have a computer at home? He's like, oh, yeah. Like, what do you do with it? He's like, oh, my doctor said I should stay mentally engaged, so I, you know, play cards online and I surf the internet. And so how long have you been using a computer, Ted? He's like, oh, I bought a computer back in 1981 or two. And I'm thinking, okay, you've been online nearly 30 years and you're 94 now, so you got online in your 60s. Okay, you just defied every stereotype we have about kind of typical users. And it reminded me really powerfully that I sometimes think we don't know how to see the most interesting things that are happening, because we're so looking for young, hip people creating iPhone applications.
Right.
You know, whatever the hottest thing is of the day, that we actually don't see all the other really rich things that are happening.
Which is probably much more vast than the things that we're looking at.
Oh, absolutely. And for me, that stuff's always really kind of hopeful.
Sure. My final question, you were recently named to Fast Company's Most Creative People, 3 spots above Tyra Banks.
So there was a little moment of going, oh my God, I'm on a list with Tyra Banks. What does that mean? And how does that work? I mean, I still haven't quite gotten my head around that particular honor.
How do you use that creativity in driving your team to that next awareness at Intel?
I mean, there's a couple of things, right? I mean, I suspect part of what I continue to bring to the technology industry in general and to Intel in particular is an ability to ask the unexpected questions. And in some ways, they're not unexpected to anthropologists. But
right.
The question that says not what are people doing, but why are they doing it? And an ability to listen not just to their answers, but to all the things they aren't saying. And I think there's a piece that says the kind of symbolic and semiotic analysis I was trained to do as a graduate student continues to be surprisingly valuable when you have to think past the kind of literalness of what people are saying to what they might really mean. So, I mean, I think that's partly what I bring to the equation. And I think also a genuine just desire to get past what everyone else is looking at.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm always sort of interested in what's the What is it that no one's talking about?
Interesting.
Because, you know, the things that we're not talking about either are the things that will catch us by surprise, or it's stuff that we've somehow tabooed out of the conversation. And for me, those are always really kind of fertile and generative spaces. I mean, I know I'm onto something when I give a talk and people leave the room or yell at me from the audience or get really squirrely or say to you things like, well, we don't need to think about this because we're thinking about this other thing. And you think, must push even harder in this particular space. So I think partly it's about just being able to see the world slightly crooked in some ways. And then I had a lot of time to think about this recently. I suspect my childhood and then the fact that I left Australia when I was 20 and moved to the United States, which has been a remarkable journey but will never be my home, mm-hmm. is a place that says part of what my edge is I'm always the outsider. I've
sure.
never lived somewhere that I was from. And frankly, when I go home to Australia, I'm not from there anymore either. I always have this slightly tilt-a-whirl kind of perspective on things, and I think that turns out to be really productive.
Well, thank you very much for being with us today. It's been a pleasure to talk to you. We've wanted to do this interview for a while. Hopefully, we can get you back to the program in the future.
Absolutely, because these are the kind of questions I like to think about.